The Education Finance Committee will come to order. We do have a quorum present. So right off the bat, let's see, Representative Moran, would you like to move adoption of the minutes from the January 26th meeting?
Yes, absolutely.
All right, Representative Moran has moved adoption and approval of the minutes from January 26th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of Representative Moran's motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Thank you very much, Representative Moran. Minutes are approved. Before we get going, I just wanted to recognize some young visitors we have to the committee today. We have a number of shadow students here from the Minnesota Family, Career, and Community Leaders Association. And so I told the young woman who's shadowing me, Taya, that I was going to embarrass you all, so I apologize if you're not comfortable with this, but you're community leaders, so I'm guessing you're used to this. If you would all just stand up, and real quickly, we'll start over here and then come around to this side. Just tell us your name and where you're from.
I'm Johanna Nielsen. I'm from South and Marshall, Minnesota. I go to RCR High School.
Hi, I'm Maya Christensen. I'm from
I'm Eskil Joshik, and I live in Lancaster. I go to Lancaster High School.
I'm Savage, and
I'm from Medina. I'm Zach Deere, and I go to Provo.
I'm Mariah Olson, and I also go to Lancaster.
Hi, I'm Kelly Kramer, and I go to Wheaton.
I'm Gracie Bathauer, and I go to Wheaton.
Welcome. Well, thank you so much. We're really glad to have you all with us. Great to see young people here and interested in what we're doing at the Education Committee. And some of you may remember, in 1 minute, Representative Murphy, I may have mentioned this last year when the FCCLA leaders were here with us, but many, many, many years ago, growing up in South Dakota, I was a future homemaker of America, which I think maybe was the precursor to this organization, and was a state officer in our group. And it was a really valuable leadership experience. So glad to see you here. Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, when I was a little kid in my neighborhood, there weren't very many kids. But Barry Walbert was from three houses down, and he was always at least once or twice a year with his family going to Lancaster, and that was always across the state, and so we're going across the state to Lancaster, and so to have three or four kids here from Lancaster, that's really great. And now I know that there's people up across the street to see.
Yes,
so I think it's really good that students are doing that, whether from across the state or right next door, that they're participating. So thank you for coming.
Yes, I love it when we have students that come and come to committee. And so tell your friends. We want you all to come and visit, and we learn a lot from you. If we have time, we'll ask you if you have anything you want to say after the end of committee. But we've got a big agenda today. So, all right. With that, today's hearing is going to be just an overview of our special education programs. I don't think we did an overview on special education last session at all in the 15-16 session year. So this is going to be beneficial for the chair as well as hopefully new members of the committee and the rest of us. So welcome. And I think our Ways and Means chair is visiting with us today. Representative Knobloch, welcome.
Well, thanks. I am an ex officio member of the committee. I brought my own name tag. you won't see me real often, but once in a while.
All right. Well, we welcome you anytime you can join us. Thank you for being here. So, all right. So I think what we're going to do is we're going to start with witness from Intermediate District 287, Ms. Rogers, who's the Executive Director of Special Services and Education Programs. And for all the witnesses, if you would please just identify yourself and who you're with before you provide your testimony so we get that on the tape. And, before we start with that, just a quick note, members, we did have at our last meeting on Perpich and the OLA report on Perpich. I had an opportunity to speak with Mr. Vanderkooy after the meeting. There was some correspondence he had had with Representative Ward, and he had copies, and I just wanted to make sure that that was something he wanted distributed, because I wasn't sure if it was private communication or not, and he said yes, so it is in all of your packets today. So just to let you know that again, he's the I think it's the acting board director, chairman of the board, or the new chair of the board for Perpich, and he came and offered some testimony, and so he had some correspondence with Representative Ward, and so he had asked that be made part of the record and part of the information for the committee. So it is in there. And all right. And any other information that comes to us as a result of that hearing, and we will probably return to that topic sometime later yet this session, but we'll make sure that we keep you updated. And one last final announcement. We did have a couple of members ask for copies of the education budget, the governor's education budget. But if anyone else would like a copy for tomorrow, we are having the commissioner back to resume discussion of the governor's budget proposal. Please let our CLA, Ms. Keynes, know today so that we can get those copies made for everyone and have them for tomorrow's hearing. All right? Those are my public service announcements for right now. And with that, Ms. Rogers, welcome.
Good afternoon. I am Elizabeth Lodge Rogers, and I am the Executive Director of Student Services and Education Programs for Intermediate District 287. We serve the West Metro. Chair Loon and members of the committee, I really am appreciative of the opportunity to be here today and to speak with you a little bit about the special education process. The linchpin, if you will, of the special education process is the individual education program. And that is where our energy around documenting due process procedural safeguards occurs for members of the educational team and the parents and family and the student. And so I will focus on that aspect of the process. I've worked in special education for 33 years. I've served as an EBD teacher, that is working with students with emotional and behavioral disorders. I've actually prepared special education and general education teachers. And in the last 15 years have worked in special education administration. So that's the perspective I bring to you today. I now have the privilege of serving each day 1,000 students that come through our doors in District 287. And I really would like to give you the perspective of the challenges that both our teachers and our students face at the ground level, as well as provide you with an overview of the individual education program process. Before we move into those specifics of the process, I want to share a little about some of the contextual challenges. And I actually provided in your handout packet an infographic that summarizes that. But I want you to be able to better understand how removing some of the red tape around paperwork can be more helpful. Here are six major challenges that our special education teachers face and that would be helpful, I think, for you to understand. First, safety. In my district, just like many others in Minnesota, students come from school with increasing severe mental health needs. Their needs extend far beyond the educational services outlined in the IEP that the school can provide. This school year alone, in my district, we've had 125 critical incidences and 150 staff injuries. And I also provided you with a glance of our data from last year. The severity of needs and the critical incidents is unprecedented. And yet, We have the responsibility of public schools to serve these students. There's been a shift in the responsibility for children's mental health from state and county provided services to public schools that's happened without a policy discussion and without sufficient funding. As a result, public schools have become the de facto mental health system for Minnesota's 125,000 students who receive special education services, at least during the school day. The lack of community resources requires schools and our special education teachers to fill in the gaps as de facto nurses, therapists, food shelves, and laundromats. Teachers are trying to meet all the students' basic needs so that they are ready to learn while they are in school. On a more severe level, for example, in programs that serve federal Setting 4 students, that is separate sites where the student spends all their time in special education, those are the programs that Intermediate District 287 provides, and my colleagues across the state have Setting 4 or federal Setting 4 programs. In those situations, we as a school district exhaust all options within our reach to serve the students. We seek lifelines from hospital emergency rooms, treatment centers, crisis lines, and other providers. More times than not, students are turned away because their behaviors are too dangerous, yet they return to school the very next day. Each year in the state of Minnesota, our schools spend $600 million in regular education funding to subsidize the special education costs. This gap in funding, known as the special education cross-subsidy, is a significant reason that school districts face funding challenges year after year. Continuing with the context, I want to say I've been a special educator for my entire career. I have dedicated my professional life to serving students and families and their families. And we do have a moral and ethical responsibility to serve all students. It's also the law, yet neither state or the federal governments reimburse school districts for anything close to the true cost of services. In my district, for a student with severe, complex needs, this cost can reach up to over $100,000 a year prior to reimbursement. Yet, it's their right to a free and appropriate public education. And I have to balance that right all the time with the safety, the psychological safety and the physical safety of my staff. And again, I want to give you this sense of context. Inequities in resources mean that we do not implement early intervention programs, among many other variables that result in disproportionate number of students of color being identified, determined eligible, and receiving special education services. And it makes sense that the burden of educating students with more complex need increases over the years. So does the burden around managing that educational program and ensuring that we're meeting those needs and documenting those needs and making sure that everyone is informed and that we're following all aspects of what's required of us. So, along with the challenges, the day-to-day work that our teachers face, special education teachers spend hours and hours completing sometimes very redundant paperwork. There is a strong sentiment in the profession that the significant portions of this paperwork is unhelpful to families, teachers, and certainly to the students. Within this IEP process, which I will explain to you, most of the significant burdens are with the documentation of due process and those documents that are redundant and sometimes confusing in their redundancy for the parents and families. We know, and we've brought this conversation forward to legislators, is that in many cases, Minnesota exceeds federal requirements around the provision of special education services. And I would say that in many of those areas, I applaud that, and I'm honored to work in a state that really thinks carefully. There are some areas, though, that we far exceed the burden as outlined in the federal guidelines, and are certainly areas that would merit consideration. And again, our basic funding doesn't allow us to support teachers in the work of teaching and manage the burden that is placed on due process, procedural safeguards, and the documentation thereof. That brings me to the teacher shortage. Again, an important context. The teacher shortage has hit special education particularly hard. It's hard to get teachers. It's even harder to keep them. Teacher burnout is just as serious of an issue as the shortage. Teachers leave the profession for many reasons. For one, they experience trauma, witnessing disturbing behavior, sexualized behavior, overt suicidal actions, overt homicidal ideation expressed to them, hopelessness in children and families that are unable to navigate the complex systems of support. They experience this trauma every day, along with diminishing resources, increased workload and caseload. They can't keep up with the overwhelming demands of the documentation or paperwork for due process, and so they leave the field. That is a context for you as you consider the very important and yet complicated process around developing a student's individual educational program. Teachers want to teach. They really want to teach. Special education teachers, they find themselves in time spent completing required forms, completing redundant reports, meeting very specific timelines, all under a cloud of worry that they have made an error in documenting what they are doing for that student. This, instead of planning relevant, personalized, and engaging instruction for their students. It's frustrating. So, let's take a fairly quick trip, and you'll forgive me. I have done a lot of work in academia preparing teachers. So, when Ms. Roberts contacted me and said, provide kind of a special education 101, I thought, oh, that's a semester-long class, but I'll try to compact that into a most salient point. And happy to provide anyone with some offline tutorials. You know, the day in the life of a special education teacher begins with, or the focus, and again, there are many steps to the special education process, from screening children, our child find, where we identify kids who may be at risk, to screening and seeing where is the student functioning, to then initiating with parent consents and through a process, comprehensive multidisciplinary evaluation to arrive at determining eligibility for services. That's pretty complicated. Once we get that done, we move into planning that very important individual education program, which consists of a team meeting. And there are two types of IEP, and I'll use the acronym if that's good, if I've said it enough now, IEP, Individual Educational Program. There's initial IEPs, and then there's the annual, or annual IEPs only. The annual piece about that is it has to happen every year, but frequently, particularly as students have complex needs, we hold multiple IEP team meetings within a calendar year. So the initial IEP, when the student's been evaluated and found to be eligible for special education services, and that IEP must be developed before services begin. The first meeting has to be held within 30 calendar days after a child's been found eligible for special education and related services. The annual IEP meeting, and again, this has to occur at least annually, but frequently occurs more often, is one that each year we review the progress of the student, check in to see where are their continued areas of needs, where have things changed, and we write a new plan. And that occurs each year. When you consider the burden, if you will, of the plan development, just consider this. Oh, excuse me. Just consider this. An IEP for a student who is receiving maybe, has less significant needs, maybe needs some additional supports, but is not spending more than an hour on average a day in special education services. That whole IEP process for the IEP manager, who is the special education teacher in charge of making sure that an IEP is developed, it's complete through the team process, and implemented, that it's going to take that teacher at least 4 hours, maybe up to 10. So multiply that by a caseload of students for a teacher in a general education setting. I know when I worked in an independent district, for depending on the disabilities of the students, we looked at, and where the students' needs were, we looked at that workload, caseload, but teachers could have 13, 15, 18, 20 folks on their caseload. So that's for students with needs, but not in the complex realm. Just keeping that in mind. The first thing that happens, we must, of course, invite the parent. The parent or guardian has the right to participate in all school meetings, and why wouldn't they? That discuss their child's identification, the evaluation, the placement decisions, and that provision of a free and appropriate public education. The purpose of that is to develop and to plan for, revise as needed, and document that program for that individual student. The responsibility for organizing and conducting those IEP meetings falls on the school, and I mentioned before that occurs at least the annual, at least once a year. In addition to the parent, other team members include the student as appropriate, and that's a kind of a decision that students and families and IEP, the special education teacher, and other staff working with that student make about their level of participation, but always the parent or guardian, a school district representative that is typically an administrator, because that person needs to be able to speak to general education, the requirements, the general education common core state standards, for example, what are expectations for typical kids? That member of the team needs to be able to speak to that, as well as be able to speak to the resources that the school district provides. And they need to be qualified to teach or supervise in special education. The special education teacher, that IEP manager, or some folks use the term case manager. That IEP manager is a member of the team, and any other special education teacher or service provider, such as an occupational therapist, speech and language clinician, physical therapist, any other service provider who may be also serving that student is a member of the team. General or regular education teacher, if the student participates in a regular education environment, which most students in special education do. And consider this, if you're a high school student receiving eligible and receiving special education services, every one of your high school teachers is a member of that team, right? And you might have 5 or 6 content area teachers supporting you. And then always someone that's qualified to interpret the evaluation results and understand those implications around needs and interpret that and support the team in understanding that. In our state, that is a school psychologist, most in general. So we have the team identified. We have to invite the team to come. And here we, and this is a process as well. For some, and I want to make sure that I don't misspeak, so I'm just going to grab my notes here. Some students that I work with, depending on the complexity of the case, we're talking about 17 people that are members of a team that need to, calendars need to be looked at and a time identified that works, of course, for the family, the parent. And then in, part of what we have to do is agree or reach agreement with the parent in writing for those team members who may be excused or not excused from the meeting. You're talking about a team of 9 people all the way up to 17, 18. We're talking about a lot of communication. We do have a form we use and teachers use in the state of Minnesota to send out. It's called the Notice of a Team Meeting. Our colleagues in the department have repeatedly told us, because we talked about this Notice of a Team Meeting and whether that's a required form or not, they remind us it is not required, but yet if it's not present, for example, if we have a dispute and we go to a complaint or even a due process hearing, which is part of our dispute resolution, if we don't have that documented notice of a team meeting describing the agreement around who was excused and who was not, that becomes a problem for the school district. And I just have to be frank about that. When we do our review, our self-review for compliance and monitoring, that comes up if we do not provide documentation of that notice of a team meeting. So now the teacher, now the IEP manager, contact a parent, gotten calendars organized, set upon a date, there's agreement on who will be there and who will not, we come to the meeting. And in this meeting, we have to talk about basically 5 areas. What are the student's strengths? We want parent input on that. We want each educational team, IEP team member's input on that. We want to be able to address parent concerns, questions, thoughts about where their student is, where they want to see them go for the next year. And as a teacher, really, I know myself as a teacher and the teachers that I work with, it's really best practice to kind of have a planning meeting around the IEP meeting with the parent and guardian, just so we all know where we're starting. Sometimes that happens by phone. Sometimes that's face-to-face, but that is best practice, and certainly I, as a parent, would appreciate that opportunity for input. We have to address and discuss the results of the most recent evaluation. We have to talk about how is the student doing? Are they making progress? And where we are, and then any special factors. So, with that, the IEP manager develops an agenda. That agenda is shared. Another piece of documentation, not required, but certainly best practice to facilitate a meeting. At the meeting, I'm not going to go through each area, but there are a myriad of areas that have to be addressed. And a draft of that IEP is developed within the meeting and agreement reached, and then it's finalized. What is important to note, and again, I won't belabor each of these areas. You can review those, and you may have some questions about them. But what is clear is that at the end of the day, when the meeting is over, there are multiple areas that have to be completed. And I believe I counted it up. It's at least 21 fields completed in an IEP, and we all use electronic IEP systems, and then 3 fields for each annual goal that we set as a target. So those, and IEP can range from 8 to 10 pages in length for a less complex student to 20 to 24 pages in length. Another part that I won't belabor is that each student who cannot meet the general expectations of the school around discipline and behavioral expectations needs to have a positive behavior support plan that's developed as a part of an IEP team meeting. And after the meeting, of course, we want meeting notes. We want those shared. We want to review and revise and edit that IEP for completeness. And then we prepare a prior written notice, which I will discuss. A prior written notice is the notice to the parent that accompanies the IEP copy, the document. And that notice summarizes what is in the IEP. And this would be one of those confusing and somewhat redundant components that we would love to seek relief. The purpose is to make it, to provide clarity to the family. I'll share with you the responses that we have to provide in that prior written notice. A description of the action proposed or refused by the district. An explanation of why the district proposes or refuses to take action. A description of any other options that the district considered and the reasons why these options were rejected. A description of each evaluation procedure, test, record, or report that the district used as a basis for the proposed or refused action. And a description of any other factors that are relevant to the district's proposal and refusal. And that has to be documented and clearly articulated, and again, is somewhat redundant to the contents of the IEP. It is redundant. Included with that, of course, is a notice of procedural safeguards for families so that they get that with that. So many things get in the way of planning and delivering instruction for our special education teachers. I mentioned already the burden around the actual IEP with 21 fields and 3 per IEP goal, the length, the time, the notice of the team meeting, and just there isn't anyone that would say we shouldn't have parent involvement. It's just the documenting each step and having that follow a specific format with certain content that becomes burdensome and time-consuming. we have a requirement that if a student ends up needing the use of a restrictive procedure two or more times in a month, we have to hold an IEP meeting. That makes sense if that's a student who does not have a positive behavior support plan in place, or if this is there's a dramatic change. But ironically, in the actual positive behavior support plan, one must put review dates and schedules in and provide progress. So in a district such as mine, where a student might experience three restrictive procedures a week, you can see that this requirement of a team meeting becomes difficult. I mentioned the prior written notice already, and there are just so many components to that, and I can provide you detail on the prior written notice and that complexity. We are and would always want to be a part of our continuous improvement process, which our colleagues at department help us develop. But in that review, sometimes there are some requirements where we might have to go back over an error in the documentation or the paperwork and resend to a parent a prior written notice that then addresses more fully that action that took even a year ago. And so then the parent's confused. Why am I getting this prior written notice? Well, we're correcting the prior written notice that was from a year ago. We're required to do this. And there are just some aspects of that that become puzzling at best and certainly confusing for our families and burdensome. I know there's been a lot of talk about an online common IEP system. We all have electronic systems. I don't think that that will resolve, will reduce our burden of paperwork by 25% unless we actually look at the mechanics and the requirements required of us within the documenting in the IEP. That would be my consideration to give you. Finally, teacher shortage and the retention of teachers is real. I have over 70 teachers in District 287 that are either on a non-licensed community expert, on a variance, so they're teaching outside of their licensure area, or using an innovation waiver. What does that mean? Well, I don't have enough candidates that are qualified for our positions, A. B, I lose teachers because of the overwhelming nature and the demands that are increasing and changing. Colleges and university programs really don't have the capacity to teach the significant nuances of all this documentation or paperwork required without fear and risk of losing potential and existing program students in their programs. No one comes to the profession to teach exceptional students to do paperwork slogging. Rather, they are brought to the profession for their creativity and belief that all students can learn and that all students can make progress. We've really experienced mission creep around due process and procedural safeguards and the documentation thereof because of case law and losing sight of the real work, which is progress in learning, student achievement, and moving students to be productive contributing members as adults in our society. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Rogers. I appreciate that thorough review of some of the processes and the challenges with providing special education to our students. Representative Slocum, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I should fully disclose my biases here. My daughter is an intermediate district special ed teacher for behavior high school with Capital View in north of St. Paul. So I know, I hear the stories and then some. Last year we gave the Department of Education a mandate to a directive, let's be nice about it, a directive to simplify, streamline, lighten the special ed paperwork. Have intermediate districts been at the table for this process to lighten and streamline, to your knowledge? And if so, have you felt the input from intermediate districts has been significant enough to accomplish this legislative mandate?
Ms. Rogers.
I do think that the department has sought feedback and input on this, not only from our intermediates, and yes, we're present at those discussions when those occur, but also from districts across the state. I have to be frank that I haven't seen real promise or movement.
Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your frankness. Never ask a question you don't know the answer to. I have a second. May I ask a second question?
Yes, you may.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you had a magic wand, which, unless you're hiding it somewhere, you don't have it, but if you had a magic wand, what one thing could this legislature do, this one, this year, do to make an impact with the students and to help the teachers?
Ms. Rogers.
Well,
be frank.
Yes, please.
If I had a magic wand, I would certainly take the opportunity, along with my colleagues across the state, to not only provide our feedback on where the documentation of due process and procedural safeguards can be reduced, but that would happen. And I'll be honest, I'm not sure what the mechanism for that is. One solution, if I can have a two for one on my magic wand, one solution is if we had less of a pinch on resources, I would be able to, and as would my colleagues, be able to have at least some clerical supports for our professional special education teachers to assume some of the scheduling and the calling and the documenting and the mailing and the copying and the scheduling. And because we are limited in our resources, I'm not going to reduce teachers and educational assistants supporting students to put a clerical person in place. I can't do that. I just can't. So that would be part two. Chair Loon.
Thank you. I'm listening. Representative Slocum, did you have another question?
I do, but let's let others talk.
Okay. Representative Thiessen.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So has anybody done like a matrix where they've actually written out what all these requirements are at the federal level and then what the state additional requirements are? I mean, are those, I'm new to the committee, so does that exist somewhere? Because we keep hearing about these, but no one has ever, like, specific about what they are. And the only way we're going to fix it, seems to me, is if we actually know what the specifics are. Mm-hmm.
Ms. Rogers.
Well, myself, with a committee of folks from MACE, from our association, a number of years ago, developed a pretty comprehensive document. And I'm sure that as I look at our executive director, we'd be happy to share with that, and we could update that to provide that.
Representative Thiessen?
That'd be great.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to follow up on your comment, there's nothing that prevents your district from putting clerical people in to help you, right? That's just a decision that the administrative office can make.
Yes. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here, Dr. Rogers. I think this is a question that could probably generate a lot of stuff, but the intent is not to generate a lot of stuff. But it's kind of a begging question. You opened up your testimony. I know we focused a lot on the process, reporting elements, all the mechanical pieces that have really created a heavily encumbered system, even as it's seeking to provide equity and access and good outcomes. But prior to all that, you opened up by sharing an increase in severe mental health as a an observation of what's happening in our society that is creating a volume here that perhaps is unprecedented or that we're not prepared for, not quite sure. What should we be doing to understand what that is, what's driving that? And I suspect there's different opinions on that. In addition to paying attention to these mechanical pieces, what should we be doing, given the responsibility we have to these students, to this public deliberative education, to the people of Minnesota whose children apparently are facing something that might be unprecedented, that certainly is contributing to the challenges before us.
Ms. Ryan.
Well, 2 minutes or less.
2 minutes or less. But I do believe that some of you at the table, including Chair Loon, are aware that the intermediate districts have collaborated on a concept that hopefully you'll have the opportunity to hear about from those superintendents around in which we offer a specific solution for how to bring in all our partners that serve our students together. I mentioned the burden on public schools and that we become the de facto mental health services provider, and what's happened is that decades ago we rightly so looked at deinstitutionalization of individuals with significant disabilities, rightly so, but the promise of community-based services and supports never met that need, and in fact have decreased. And so what that means is that Department of Health and Human Services and county services, those all of us are really must work together to come up with a solution that does not rest both in terms of responsibility and funding in the public school sector, where we have zero reject. Right? Every student gets the right to free, appropriate public education, regardless how they arrive at school today.
Thank you. And I do need to bring up our next group of witnesses from the department, but if Dr. Rogers, if you're able to stay, in case we get back to questions and need you to come forward, if that would be all right. Thank you. So with that, I'm going to ask our representatives from the department to come forward.
Good
All right, well, welcome, Assistant Commissioner. I'm assuming you're going to lead off on this. And if you would all just introduce yourselves for the records when you're planning to speak. And then I think what we'll do is after you're done, we'll have Dr. Melcher come up to talk about, because the funding formula was changed a few years ago. So just to do a brief explanation of that to help the committee get a full picture of then also how we fund these special education services. And then we'll move to questions. So Assistant Commissioner Corte, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Darren Corte. I'm an Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Education. Two of the areas that I oversee are our Special Education Division as well as our Compliance and Assistance Division. I have with me today Robin Whidley, who is our State Director of Special Education. Robin has been with the department since the early 90s. She's a licensed special education director, former special education teacher and coordinator. I also have Mary Kay Kanega-Litzau, who is our Director of Compliance and Assistance. Mary Kay is an attorney, has been with the department since 2000, and prior to her work, the department served as a child support administrative law judge. So I'm very happy to have these two on our team, and they're going to walk you through some more detail of the special education programs, both on the policy side as well as the compliance and due process side. But I'll start just by first talking a little bit about the Americans with Disabilities Education Act, which is the federal law that governs a lot of the work that we're talking about today. Obviously, there's state law as well, but IDEA was, as we call it, was first passed by Congress in 1975. It's been reauthorized a number of times since then. The last time was in 2004, so we're well overdue for a reauthorization for IDEA. And the general tenets of idea are that students with disabling conditions need to be receiving a free and appropriate public education to meet their unique needs. And then there is, of course, accompanying regulations that were developed and promulgated by the U.S. Department of Education that govern how that statute is implemented. We put those citations on the PowerPoint for you so you can look at those in more detail if you'd like. IDEA is broken up into two large parts, as we normally talk about it, and those are Part B and Part C. Part B governs funding and services for children with disabilities from age 3 to 21. And then Part C is for our youngest learners, and that provides guidelines concerning funding and services for children with disabilities at or have risk conditions from birth to age 3. And we are very proud that Minnesota is a birth to age 3 state. Not every state is, but we do provide special education for all students from birth to 21. So I'll hand it over to Ms. Whidley to talk a little bit more in detail about the contents of IDEA and what's required under Part B and Part C.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm so happy to be here today. We've had a great presentation from Elizabeth, and she spent lots of time on the IEP process, so some of the slides that are in our presentation we'll be able to gloss over quite quickly. But we really do want to spend a little bit of time talking with you about what's included in the law. As we think about Part B services, once again, those are services for children ages 3 through 21. We do have requirements that are set forth, and we want everyone to be aware of them. They relate to some of the conversation that Elizabeth had with you already regarding child find, meaning identifying children, the eligibility process, which deals with evaluation, and also the development of the individualized educational program. And she talked about that. She also referenced that it's really important that everyone understand that within an IEP, that provides for a free, appropriate public education, what we know as FAPE, which means that public education is provided at no cost to families, in the least restrictive environment, which is also known as the most integrated setting. And the purpose of our services is primarily to enable students with disabilities to be involved in and make progress in grade-level curriculum. I'm not going to go over this slide very much because we've had a great conversation with Elizabeth. This slide tells you who's on the IEP team, and it also informs you what the content of an IEP is. As we move to the other part of IDEA, which refers to Part C services, once again, as Darren referenced, those are the services, the part of the law that speaks to services available to children who are ages birth to three, who are disabled or maybe at risk for disabilities. We are very proud of our program here in Minnesota. And as Darren said, we do have a mandate down to special education down to birth, and we are one of the few states in the country that has that mandate. Doctors and or parents can make referrals for this statewide program through the Help Me Grow Minnesota program, and there is a different kind of plan available for these young infants and toddlers with disabilities that's called an Individualized Family Service Plan, an IFSP. An IFSP is very similar to what's included in an IEP, other than it has terrific involvement of the family. It also includes community resources that might be needed. And we certainly want to make sure that most of the services are provided in the home setting to the child and family. Now I'd like to spend just a little bit of time on another specific requirement. When Ms. Roberts, when Amy visited with us, she asked us to make sure we spend a little time on identification. You've heard about that already from Elizabeth, but in terms of the IDEA requirement, the purpose of ChildFind is to identify students with disabilities through referral and evaluation activities at the local level. And a local public school district must provide these ChildFind services to all kids here in Minnesota. And that includes a referral or parent request for evaluation, where a team of professionals would come together and determine if evaluation and assessment is needed. Here in Minnesota, we have 13 categories that we use to identify children with disabilities, ages birth through 21. Once again, we're a birth mandate state. And these 13 categories align to and are very similar to what is called forth in IDEA, and we also have statewide criteria in our Minnesota rules, which is in Chapter 1325 through 1352. So we have statewide criteria that are promulgated through our state rules for those different 13 categories. Once again, we reiterate again that we serve children ages birth through 2 and 3 through 21 through those two programs. We wanted to list out for you the various categorical areas for special education, and we listed them from most common to least common in terms of our current child count. So the most, and I think you also have a handout that was given to you probably by someone here on the committee that has a chart related to child count also. It didn't come from the department, but it must have come from something on the department, right, Mr. Strom? Is that right? Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. So that's there for you to refer to. So we just wanted to make sure that you saw the various categorical disability areas that we have here in Minnesota, and they go from most common to least common. The next slide is one that we thought it would be important to share what our child count every December 1st, districts send in to us what the number of children that are on IEPs in their district. And the child count is used for purposes of funding and also some other kind of service provision. We wanted you to see the numbers from school year 2015-16 and 2016-17. So you have numbers related to all students on IEPs or IFSPs ages birth to 21, and then also the percentage. And sometimes folks want to want to know the percentage of students who are receiving special education here in Minnesota. So this year, we have 15.7% of students enrolled in Minnesota public schools. That includes charter schools who receive special education through either an IEP or an IFSP. And it also shows you the number of general education students at the bottom of that table. I think I'll move on to the next chart, if that's sure everyone's still with me. This one we wanted to share with you related to questions we had for distribution of race and ethnicity in Minnesota special education and general education student enrollment. And this is for this year. You will note that we have three different columns. The column on the right side of your page, it indicates all students ages, this is students ages, I think this is birth to 21 for general education. At the blue, the bottom blue box is white. As it says, the orange is black. The gray is Hispanic, the yellow is Asian, Pacific Islander, and then the top smaller box is the American Indian. So then you have the birth to 21, 3 to 21, and 6 to 21 count. This is here for your references. That was a question that you all had. And I don't think I need to say anything more about that. Then we wanted to share with you another chart regarding distribution of race and ethnicity across primary disability categories. So this is for this year, looking at our special education population across the various categorical disability areas and how the racial distribution occurs within the category. And it certainly is noted that within certain categories, there may be some differences with regard to race in terms of who is identified. The last couple charts that we have in this section of our presentation, we just wanted to make sure that you saw the numbers. And so one chart is student count of children across the different racial and ethnic groups, also by all students and by special ed count and the various disability categories. So we have 0 to 21, we have students ages 3 to 21, and we have students ages 6 to 21. Sometimes that's interesting for certain people who love numbers, so we wanted to make sure that you had that, those charts.
And excuse me, if I could just ask a question, because without staring at the numbers and taking time to figure it out. The between the B and the C level, so the birth to 2 and then the 3 to 21,
mm-hmm.
As a percentage of students categorized as needing special education services, do you know what the breakdown is? Like how many...
Madam Chair, I should know that, and I'm thinking I don't want to misstate that. I thought it was something close to 5 to 6% of students ages that's birth to 5, that maybe within birth to 3. We used to have a hit rate. I used to be in the early childhood special education program long ago, and we wanted to the criteria was set for us to identify up to 3 to 4%. So I can go back and check on that, and then we can get that information back to you, because that's a very good question.
Thank you.
And then, Madam Chair, if you also look at a few slides back, we have the child count there, and you can see that from birth to 21, we do usually have a higher percentage, higher number identified, because we're also not just looking at students who have been identified, but also students who are at risk.
At risk.
So we have a number who will drop off after they get past that Part C to Part B break, or from Part B into when you get into kind of your traditional K-12 system.
Thank you. And I believe Chair Knobloch has a question.
Well, Madam Chair, in answer to your question to the witnesses, I can't you, if you're looking for what is the population of 0 to 3, can't you just look at the 0 to 21 slide and see where it says the special ed count is 137,601, and then look at the next slide where it says the age 3 to 21 is 132,151 and subtract them, so you'd have about 5,500 students or children.
Madam Chair, Representative Knobloch, that'd be great, and I think that's exactly why you have your Ways and Means Chair as a ex officio member.
He's the numbers guy for a reason. Thank you. All right. Please proceed. Thank you.
Okay, the next portion of our presentation relates to, we wanted to share with you, so how are we doing as a state? So these results come from an annual, every year, each state needs to submit an annual performance report on February 1st, which is today, so we're very excited about submitting the report to the U.S. Department of Education. And this includes some data on selected performance indicators, such as graduation, assessment, and participation in the most integrated setting. This report is reviewed every year by Office of Special Education Program staff, and each state gets a determination for needed assistance on results, and that is given to us each July. They reviewed our most recent submission, which was last year, of our annual performance report, and they made the determination, and we met requirements, which is the highest designation that a state can receive. So we always are really excited when we get that, and we were one of 23 states that received this determination. Now we wanted to share with you just a couple of results indicators that might be of interest. In terms of our graduation rates for youth with disabilities, kids on IEPs, and this is the four-year cohort rate, as you see, we've been pretty consistent across the years, and we are at a 61.1% graduation rate for the four-year cohort. By no means do we want you to misunderstand this, because there certainly are students who continue in school past ages 18 and 19 based on their goals and objectives, IEP, and their needs. And those students certainly are considered to be graduated at a different time. And we are happy to say that we are looking at 6 and 7 year cohorts. But that is not what is reported to the federal government, because that's not what they've used for us yet. That may be something that comes up in our Every Student Succeed Act results.
But we do have 5 and 6 year graduation rates available to you for these students if the committee is interested in taking a look at that, which obviously those numbers are higher.
Thank you.
Then the next indicator that we wanted to provide some information to you on relates to the dropout rates for youth that are on IEPs. We've remained fairly stable over the past 5 years, and we didn't have the most recent dropout rate available for today's purposes. So we now have 2014-15 year data.
Right. And Representative Scott had a question.
Madam Chair, thank you for your presentation. Do you have those graduation rates broken down by race, too, so we could see if there are any connections between the achievement gap across the board or...
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, absolutely, we do have that, and we'll make sure to provide it to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry to disrupt you, but I think it might be easier if we just ask the questions as we go.
That's great. That's great.
Well, not just Madam Chair.
Excuse me. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have more of a general question, and that is, you know, I see that you have these, the Department of Education reaches out to families from birth to 3, and I'm wondering if there are other state agencies that also reach out to these same families and what resources are available to them via other agencies, if you know the answer.
I can provide a bit of, member, representative, I can provide a bit of a response, and there might be other folks from Department of Human Services and the Department of Health who also would be really helpful. But yes, we have had any number of family support activities available in other agencies, and we also have PACER as our partner in family engagement and family training, family involvement for children with disabilities ages birth through 21, and that does include birth to 3.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, Ms. Woodley. Thank you. You may proceed.
The next piece of information we'd like to share with you is this is Each state needs to spend some time and report to OSEP. The percent of time that youth with disabilities are involved with their age peers. And we are happy to say that we have a consistent, a bit of a small increase over the past. Well, no, it's not an increase. It's pretty stable with those students who spend at least 80% of their day with their age peers in schools. That's what our the blue bar is. And then the other information on this page relates to if, in fact, they are in not with their regular class, and that might be some of the children that Elizabeth's presentation was referring to. And then there are some students who are in separate schools, and they are not with their age peers at all. We are one of the states we are interested in looking at. Looking at other data from the U.S. Congressional report to determine where we are in comparison to other states on this indicator. And much of our work in the Minnesota Olmstead Plan area, if in fact you've had a presentation about that or are aware of that, relates to this indicator. We want children to live, learn, work, and play in their most integrated setting possible here in Minnesota. The next chart relates to work that we do with public schools that shows us, so when students leave school, what happens to them? We want them to be as successful as possible. So there is a post-school outcome survey that is used, and it's sent out one-fifth of school districts every 5 years. And it is a phone survey, and districts are asked to phone leaver, the students that leave their program for some reason. They may graduate, they may drop out, but we want to know what's happened with them. So we are really excited to share the trends that we see here. We have more students that once they leave public school, meaning they've graduated, they're going into some sort of competitive employment situation. We are most happy to show, and that would be the red area on the bar. If we look at the purplish kind of area, the top on the bar, we're excited to show that is going down. That's the non-engaged group, meaning we've called them, the district staff calls them, and they aren't doing anything. We certainly don't want our youth, once they leave school, to not be part of an employment situation, going to higher education, or having some sort of schooling being provided for them. So overall, our graduation rates have been pretty stable. Our dropout rates are pretty stable. The rates for students in the most integrated setting have made some small increases over the past, we had 4-year data, and that should say 2 years. We're really excited about the increase in students who are competitively employed, and overall, many youth with disabilities are engaging in something. They aren't just sitting home, and excitement about that. So our partners, our colleagues at the local school district level, families, and other agencies, we really thank them for the work that they've done to help our results look so positive.
Madam Chair, I'd then hand it over to Ms. Konega-Litzo, who can talk a little bit about the monitoring process as well as an agency perspective on the paperwork conversation that was started at the last presentation.
Thank you. We've got a few questions, so maybe we'll take those and while we've got a little break in the presentation. Representative Thiessen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just on the slide where you have the distribution of race across disability categories, and the one that jumps out is emotional and behavioral disorders references for African-Americans, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Where the department, I know you've had some interactions with the federal government on that and some concerns they've expressed about that. Are you making any progress with regard to that, and where are we on that?
Assistant Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, we do have constant conversations with the U.S. Department of Education on this, and And it is certainly a concern for us if we have areas of disproportionality like this. We have been working closely with districts on how they identify students and the factors that they use and they're looking at identification. We also have a number of early intervention systems that we try and train districts and make sure districts are utilizing. So if there are warning signs when it comes to students that have behavioral disorders, that we can have interventions in place that would prevent them from getting to a point where they would be identified. We talk a lot about, and I know you're new to the committee, in prior years about the positive behavioral interventions and support system that we have, or PBIS. That's kind of a system that focuses on positive reinforcements and outcomes as opposed to more punitive measures like suspensions and expulsions, which tend to exacerbate disorders like emotional behavioral disorders. So we do see that there is a disproportionality there, and we are working on it, and we think it's a really important issue. It's not just something that pops up in this category. Obviously, we have academic disparities as well and discipline disparities with the same group. So it's all kind of tied together to the larger work of the department to make sure that we're addressing the needs of these students and not just kind of pushing them into a specific category.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So who does the screening to identify someone as emotionally and behaviorally disturbed? And is there cultural, is there a cultural component to the people that are actually on the screening team? Mm-hmm.
Assistant Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Representative Thiessen, you know, that's a district decision that the district would make through evaluation and use of professionals on that. Perhaps Ms. Lodge-Rogers would be better equipped to describe how that process works, but it is a district-driven process, and sometimes you use district folks, sometimes they bring in outside folks, so I couldn't speak. It varies from district to district on kind of the cultural competencies that, you know, those teams would have.
I would just echo what Darren said, and Elizabeth probably would have a really great response to your question, Representative. I would also want to say that at the department, we really have put some increased emphasis on ensuring that we don't have bias in our assessments. We have some consultants that we've been working with over the last couple of years. We have hired a person who on our staff works full-time in disproportionality issues, so that has been a change over the past 2 years.
Here, who is that? Sorry, Madam Chair.
Representative Thiessen.
Yeah. Can you just, who is that?
His name is Alex Magumbi, M-I-G-A-M-B-I, and we're really impressed with him.
Thanks.
Thank you. A few more questions, and then we'll continue. Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. What occurs, we talked about the team approach, and what occurs if the parent says, no, I don't want my child assessed? What processes do you use, or is it hands-off because the parent has said no way?
Ms. Kanaga-Litta.
Madam Chair, Representative, regarding consent, a parent would have to sign off on a consent for an evaluation plan. So that would be the first part. So if it's an initial evaluation, then this parents would have to consent. After that evaluation has taken place, the parent also has to consent in order for there to be services that are provided to the student.
Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question was, what if the parent says, I'm not going to consent? You may not evaluate my child. You may not provide services other than just standard classroom services for my child.
Ms. Kanaga-Litta.
Madam Chair, Representative, then that, yes, that is their right, and without that consent, that evaluation will not take place. So the student would be treated as a student without a disability and would be subject to the student conduct that all students are subject to in that school.
Representative Slocum.
I could do more, but I'm not going to. May I ask one more?
You may.
Madam Chair. And the other thing we've not talked about in the special ed realm is the 504 plan. And I know as a teacher I found that very useful. I used to write them, which probably is illegal, but so what?
I'm sorry, and so I didn't hear quite all of that. Were you asking about a 504 plan? Is that correct?
I'll get that on the tape. They'll come get me.
I didn't hear any of it.
Oh, good. 504 plans. I found them, as a teacher, easy to use and very useful in sort of the mild to medium special need kid and working with the parents.
Right, and I'm going to ask whoever's going to respond to just briefly tell the committee what a 504 plan is.
Yes. Ms.
Kinnick. Madam Chair, Representative. So 504 comes from a federal regulation, and that was amended in 2008. And so if a student is considered to have a disability under 504, which is a broader definition than is under IDEA. So if you think about a big circle, a 504 IDEA is a small circle inside of that. So there are many students who would not qualify for special education but could qualify for a 504 plan. And that would be providing the services that they need in order to have an equal opportunity in the classroom. And but is that considered special education services or not necessarily? Madam Chair, the 504 services can be accommodations. They can also be, they talk about it as special education services as well, but those are funded through general education. Thank you. That's a helpful clarification. All right. Thank you. Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to our presenters. All this information is very helpful. I have a question about the graduation rates and how that data is collected. I've talked to some of my local school districts and teachers about a particular element that maybe skews our graduation rates as far as it goes with special ed. But I understand that school districts, I know the one in Albert Lee does this, where some special ed students will remain on after the age of 18, maybe up through, 21? And it kind of penalizes the districts because it makes it look like those students aren't graduating when the reality is they're still being educated. So I'm wondering, does that skew your data here at all? Would it look better or maybe make it more clear as to what that rate really is for those students that are held on for more years?
Assistant Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Representative Bennett, that's a great point. It is something that we hear from a number of school districts. The four-year graduation rate is what we're required to use for accountability purposes from the U.S. Department of Education for both the what was No Child Left Behind as well as our state systemic plans for IDEA. So you're correct. If you have a student who's met all their graduation requirements at age 18, a district has to make a but that student still needs some transition services under their IEP. District kind of has a call that they have to make. Do we graduate this child, give them a diploma, and then we get counted. We get credit for their four-year graduation rate, or do we allow them to continue on and receive the services that they may need under their IEP, but then we don't get credit for that four-year graduation rate. So we do understand that dilemma, and as we've been working on our state plan for Every Student Succeeds Act, that is something that we are going to try to address, and I think Ms. Woodley mentioned it in using seven-year graduation rates so districts will get credit if they were serving a child up to age 21, but still got that student graduated in time before they were ineligible for services, that they would still get credit for that. We still are required under the law to look at four-year graduation rates, but we're also allowed to add some other factors in. So that's something that we're hoping to get into that new plan.
Thank you. Thank
you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Representative Sandstead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions for you. The first being when you were talking about the 13 categorical areas, do you have, and if not today, that's fine, but do you have historical data on how those disabilities may present from year to year as far as most common to least common?
Ms. Woodley.
Madam Chair, Representative, we could go back and get some of that information for you and send you that.
I would be curious to see if we're seeing an upswing of certain disabilities, and then maybe talking a little bit more about that at another time. Mm-hmm. And then my next question goes to the dropout rates. Mm-hmm. Do you have a, or could we at some point see a comparison of dropout rates with from students who have an IEP to regular ed students, those who do not?
Assistant Commissioner?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative, absolutely. We have those data, and we'll get them to the committee to share.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so let's we'll proceed. I think we can get through the rest of your presentation and then have Dr. Melcher come down. Ms. Kanagalitza.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm excited that you've asked us to come to speak. I have a number of information to provide in response to what Dr. Rogers talked about earlier today, and that's something that we have been working very closely with MACE with, as well as Education Minnesota, on the paperwork. But first, I just wanted to start out to give a little information about what monitoring is. So the U.S. Department of Education, the Office of Special Education Programs, their key responsibilities are to evaluate, monitor, and report on the implementation of federal policy and programs and determine the effectiveness of those programs for early intervention and educational efforts for infants, toddlers, children, and youth. So as we talked about, the students in both Part C and Part B, birth through 21. The second slide talks about state monitoring under IDEA, and just to go back one step, there's really two prongs that is under the federal law and that we do, Department of Education and Compliance and Assistance. So there's the monitoring prong, which we'll be spending most of our time talking about today, but there is also, and that's really about ensuring ongoing compliance and also providing technical assistance to the districts. But then on the other end, there's due process protections that parents have as far as special ed complaints that they can file, due process hearings, and then we offer alternative dispute resolution. So that would be mediation and facilitated team meetings. And we also, one thing that our division does is we have one person on duty every day to take phone calls. So we did more than 2,300 phone calls and email responses to people who called us, both parents and school districts, regarding questions. So then to go back, to continue on about what is state monitoring under IDEA. Monitoring has two purposes: to improve educational results and functional outcomes for students with disabilities and ensure that schools are meeting the IDEA requirements. So that's the compliance piece that we talk about, with a particular emphasis on the requirements most closely related to improving educational results for children with disabilities. That's what Dr. Rogers was talking about, and you'll, as we go on, we'll be talking about how we have changed our monitoring program, focusing on that piece. The next slide talks about, through our monitoring process, we must make sure that we collect valid and reliable data to monitor how well school districts are implementing IDEA and annual report on the performance. So Ms. Whidley talked about that earlier. How we do that is we pull student files for each district to make sure that we are getting files that will give us the information we need for the various federal indicators, as well as the different areas of disability with each district. The other piece is that the federal government states that when we identify noncompliance, that must be corrected as soon as possible and in no case later than 1 year from the date it is identified by the state. And we'll talk a little bit about this later in the presentation. So the next slide is that some of the priority areas that we have include providing FAPE in the least restrictive setting, and general supervisory areas including child fine, effective monitoring, and use of resolution meetings and mediation. So those are the dispute resolution areas that I talked about earlier, and transition services. And that is both for the students transitioning starting during ninth grade, but also from students who are transitioning from Part C to Part B. And so we pull files on each of that to ensure that we have a valid sample. And then I talked about this a little bit earlier, that IDEA requires us to have a dispute resolution system. In Minnesota, we have a very robust system with our special ed complaints due process, but also alternative dispute resolution. We have very high rates of success with both mediation, which is required, and then as a state volunteer process that is under the federal law, you can have other types of alternative dispute resolution. And so in our state, we have facilitated team meetings. So that means that a facilitator can come to the IEP meeting, and if there's a communication breakdown or some process issues, they can help that team come to an agreed-upon plan. So in 2013, there was the OLA report, and after that report, there has been several initiatives MDE has gone through. Dr. Melcher will talk about the fiscal changes, but I'll talk a little bit about in 2014 there was the Special Education Task Force caseload alignment where we revised the caseload rule. We aligned when we talked about different kinds of settings on the slide that we saw previously, the language that was in our rule didn't align with how we define settings, so that was done. And then also language was added to provide that districts have an option to provide a smaller caseload, the number of students in the classroom for students who are disruptive due to mental health issues or if there's an unsafe environment, to make sure both the students and the teachers are safe in the classroom. There was also a change to a policy. The districts must have a policy for those students that don't fit. The top part is for students who are spending more than 60% of their time with special education instruction. So for those, the majority of the students are with their non-disabled peers majority of the time. For those, each district has to have a policy, and that rule change provided many of the different data points that the district was to include. In addition, we amended a number of the rules to align with our state statute. There were 29 different recommendations that were made as part of that task force. In addition, we prioritized resources for due process trainings and to specifically provide those trainings to direct service staff, because many of the issues were that teachers, related service providers, were not understanding what they were required to do for compliance, and they wanted that training to come down to them. And so we're proud of the work that we've done there. We have provided training to over 1,150 persons in the last fiscal year, 2016. We provide CEU credits. We have online training as well. And it's to make sure that the teachers are understanding the compliance as well as the coordinators and related service providers, but also to be more efficient when filling out the forms. So if you understand what is needed in the forms, sometimes teachers might put more information in than is needed. So we're just trying to be very consistent through all of our programs as to what is required under state and federal law. So beginning, and now I'd like to talk a little bit about how we've changed our program monitoring. So there was a directive from the legislature, but also it's work that we had already begun as well. So we've met with NACE, and we also met with Education Minnesota, and we looked at all the different types of areas that we have for review. So how monitoring works is that we look at documents. So just go back, I'm sorry, one step. And that is, beginning with the 2015 school year, we changed our cycle. So we asked the school districts how they would feel about going from a 5 to a 6 year cycle for program monitoring. Or fiscal monitoring, which we're not really speaking to as much today, that stayed at a 5 year cycle. So the districts liked that. That gives them an additional year that they can focus on district level improvements. So we're 1 year into that. So this year, 2016-17, we've done a dramatic reduction in the number of areas of citations that school districts have for their review. So many of the areas that Dr. Rogers talked about are no longer part of the requirements. We have a template of the possible citations.
So those have been substantially reduced, including areas that were discussed, such as the prior written notice. The prior written notice is a very important document. It's a communication device between the parents and the districts. It's required by federal law, but we were just getting too much in the weeds regarding the how it was worded, and so not, and then not taking away from the focus on the meat of the documents that we should be looking at, the evaluation report and the individual education program. So we eliminated that as part of the criteria. Many of the notification requirements have been removed, including the excusal of teachers for meetings. Again, there's the due process is always going to be required, but by eliminating it from the citations, it doesn't have to be corrected. So as Dr. Rogers mentioned about a teacher having a year later to having to resend a prior written notice, because it is no longer listed as an area of citation, that will no longer occur. And so those are some of the major changes that were made in those documents. So again, I just want to be clear that we are focusing on the meat of the documents about how it relates to how student results. So evaluations, we're not looking at the notifications, but we're looking at the individual eligibility criteria. And then the individual educational program and the IFSP. So by eliminating, again, those documents for reviewing or portion of documents to review, special ed teachers will be spending less time having to correct those documents. And that has been a key area of concern that we have heard from the field. So the next slide shows you what some of the changes that have occurred. So the first slide, again, in Minnesota, how it works for the monitoring. Twice in a six-year period, you'll have what's called a self-review, and then you'll have a full on-site review. So a third of the state, under this new six-year, a third of the state at a time will be going through a review of documents. And that's this year it's 165 school districts. So because we pull the student files based upon information that we have in a database, we know how many documents are being pulled. And so for last year, it was approximately 35,841 pages statewide that the districts that were being reviewed, and that was about 164 last year, we're looking at. So this year, 2016-17, it's gone down to 20,873. So again, this is statewide, and that's a 30% reduction. Next, the citations. So I talked a little bit about those citations. Are what are the maximum possible things that if you're reviewing your documents, you could be found in violation? So we reduce those from 56 to 32 citations. So that is a 43% reduction. And again, those reductions are occurring by eliminating the notification documents, prior written notice, excusals, so that we're focusing on the evaluation reports and on the IEPs. Now, some districts may not yet feel this change because, of course, it is just starting. I was recently at a regional low-incident facilitator project meeting, and the directors there were talking about it, and what they found most useful was that the teachers were not having to go back and make those corrections. Are there any questions regarding the monitoring process before we move on?
Well, and I think because we are at end of our committee time, what I might do is see if we've got any other questions for the three of you, and maybe Dr. Melcher, I'm assuming maybe you were planning to be here tomorrow anyway for budget discussion? Maybe? Okay. I was going to suggest maybe we have you do a little overview of the formula change for special education funding at the beginning of our committee period tomorrow, if that's possible. Otherwise, I just don't think we'll have enough time to have you do that and time for questions. Yes, do we have members with questions? Otherwise, I had a couple of quick ones. All right, if not, so Ms. Knegelitzow, on the program monitoring data and the reductions in the number of pages, and just reflecting a little bit on Ms. Rogers' testimony, in this reduction, is it being made clear to districts that
you know, like she talked about the, you know, sort of the correction of the, and I'm going to not state it correctly, but the notification about the meeting, scheduling meeting and that, not going back and having to correct that a year later just to make sure that the paperwork's correct in the file. It sounds like you're addressing that, but are the districts sort of believing you, if you will, that they don't have to go back and do that? Because I think some of this, the sense I got from some of these efforts is that districts may feel like maybe they need this belt and suspenders approach just in case we're going to keep doing this, and that really defeats the purpose of reducing the paperwork requirements.
Madam Chair, as far as the reduction in what school districts are doing, that's going to vary depending upon the school district. Even if they were to go back and still use our old template form, the difference is that they then, and they can use that as a teaching device and to make sure that they're assured that due process is being provided in their school district. But the difference is that even if they found something that way, it's not a required citation, and so it would not be taken back to the teacher to correct.
Madam Chair.
Assistant Commissioner.
If I could add, I think that some districts will choose to take a more comprehensive approach in order to ensure that, you know, if there is a complaint filed, that they will have their I's dotted and their T's crossed. But the primary concern is that that's only going to come up if there's a complaint filed or if you get into dispute resolution, whereas this, under monitoring, if it was pulled, it doesn't matter if there was an actual impact on the student or if the parent was complaining about it. You still had to go back and fix it, whereas now you're only going to have to go back and fix it and address it if it comes to, if it arises in the dispute resolution process.
Thank you. And just one other question. You know, the purpose of the paperwork and the documentation is twofold, as I see it. One is to ensure that the federal and state requirements are being met, and that's being documented, that the child's IEP is being followed, progress monitored, that. And the other is protection against a dispute or maybe even a potential lawsuit or something that could develop. How common is the latter? I mean, I don't know if you could ballpark a percentage, but, you know, of students with an IEP, how common is it that a dispute or is brought by a parent over their child's IEP or their services?
Madam Chair, as far as a due process hearing, those are very low in the state of Minnesota, so they vary between 18 to 25 generally, and they go up and down each year.
That's a total number of?
Total of due process hearings in the state of Minnesota. We do have more special education complaints that are filed. That's a more informal process in the sense that districts generally would not hire an attorney to represent them. And then what happens if there is a complaint, then if there is a violation, then the corrective action would be generally to fix procedures, to make sure the policies are accurate.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I have seen numbers from the Coalition for Children with Disabilities that indicate that we do have one of the lowest litigation rates for special education in the country.
Thank you. Like that's a helpful context. Just in relation to a question that Representative Thiessen mentioned, is there a chart that details all of the federal and then state requirements that we have in special education? Is that something that's readily available for the committee?
Madam Chair, there was a task force that addressed the kind of exceeds issue, I believe in 2012, or was it earlier than that? So we can get you a copy of that report, but also there's an appendix in the 2013 OLA report that's pretty helpful that really details the areas where we exceed federal law in both in statute and rule.
And Madam Chair, we also have, there's a state application form on our website, and there's what's called a 608 report, and that also lists where the state exceeds.
And we'll provide that to you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. That'd be very helpful. And I'll have our staff also contact the OLA's office to get copies of that 2013 report. I think that may be helpful for members as well if they don't have one. So. All right. I'm not seeing any other questions, and I've kept everyone a little late, so I do appreciate very much all of the testifiers today. We may have more questions for you all, and either to come back or to submit to in written form. So
Thank you very much. And with that, tomorrow we will be resuming discussion of the governor's budget proposal. Again, if you would like a full copy of the education budget proposal from the governor, please let Ms. Kynes know right away so we can make copies for everyone. And with that, committee is adjourned.
Thank you.